All right, we are officially beginning our keynote event. Thank you all for coming tonight. You know, when I was putting together this panel, I thought we would just kind of swap road stories, but there's so much more to the concept of mobility that we can talk about that I strayed from that. Let's start with the obvious. You're all seasoned live performers, some of the best live performers I know, and you've played in so many different kinds of spaces, from the street to huge arenas, to festivals, to the Lilith Fair, to to jazz clubs, to Coachella, to, you know, to church. So I will ask each of you, you can choose the most joyful moment you had in your most recent touring cycle, or the most distressing. Why don't we start with Alinda?
Okay. Well, I'm actually on tour right now of the West Coast, and just yesterday I was in San Francisco, and I actually had, a couple years ago, I had played at a coffee shop across the street from the venue, and I remember looking across, there were like five people there, and I remember looking across the street going, man, that's a real venue. It would be awesome to play there one day, but that probably won't happen. So that was a pretty amazing, joyful moment to be standing at the venue that I looked at, you know, and I feel like that one street holds a lot for me, of playing in the coffee shop and then playing in the venue with where you actually have monitors and stuff like that.
Was there anything you lost from the coffee shop that you, not that you lost something like your purse or something, but what was there anything that you missed from the coffee shop?
The great thing about those types of venues is that I feel like they're always there. You know, I feel like at least life in New Orleans, where I live, New Orleans, there's everywhere is a venue. You play music everywhere. You can go sit at the coffee shop whenever you want, just start playing. No one will really mind. So I don't feel like I really lost anything. I feel like it was just really great training, you know.
What about you, Mike? What was the best or worst of the last of the many Pearl Jam tours?
There's so many bests, and to pull out, it's hard to go through. It's been 23 years. So in terms of one that I was just thinking about prior to coming on stage, we were talking backstage about Neil Young, and he had asked us to be his backup band at one time for a record we did with him called Mirrorball. And we went to Jerusalem, of all places, and played in a place called Eilat. And playing with Neil Young in Jerusalem, playing is probably the most spiritual, intense thing I've ever been through. We did Cortez the Killer, and I remember just forgetting where I was, and Neil's just doing this incredibly long, amazing solo, and we're playing on this 3,000 or 2,000-year-old Roman auditorium that's outdoors, overlooking, it was by the Red Sea, and I mean, this is a place where they would burn Christians on. It was insane. Like, the history that was back, the Romans were back in 2000. So I'm thinking about all of that stuff and playing with Neil Young. And, you know, those kind of experiences are intense. And that was an amazing experience. There are many, but that one just kind of is popping into my mind right now.
Sharon, what about you? Maybe this past tour had special meaning for you.
I think that's what my best is to say, the last tour. Because come February, I think leading up to February the 6th was the most, I mean, as long as I've been touring, but not knowing if I was going to be here to tour.
All of you may know, but Sharon recently is a survivor, a cancer survivor, mm-hmm. recently. Yeah. Went through that very human experience.
So, actually, New Year's Eve was my last chemo treatment. And then coming back, I think it was I was so nervous and so afraid. And to get back on stage, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if I was going to have the energy, you know, and preparing for that. And thank God I did the TV shows, like in January, but I was still nervous because I hadn't had a chance to get this chemo out of my body. And so you can see my nails, the effect is still affecting me. And that night, February the 6th, my band, I have such a great band, the Dap Kings. They was like, listen, Sharon, you get out there. If you get tired, here's a chair. Sit down. Don't try to dance like you used to. Just go out there and stand still. I'm like, okay. And I was so nervous. And as soon as Binky always like, Miss Sharon Jones. And I'm like, my main thing is I pray. I mean, that's just something I feel God have always blessed me with a gift. So anytime I walk on that stage, my prayer is, you know, Lord, you brought me here. You know, give me the strength. Make sure I remember all my lyrics, you know. And I walked on that stage and I felt almost like I did a year ago. And I went through this show, and when it came time to my dancing and moving, that was the most scariest thing, I think, just going back out there. But I had it, but knowing the band was behind me. So that's the experience I can say fear. But I would love to talk about other good stuff, but I had to throw that out. I think that was the hardest for me, getting back out in February, not knowing I was going to be able to do what I've been doing.
Yeah. Michelle, any tour stories? Good, bad, evil?
After that, I guess I'd say the worst times are when you just don't appreciate it, where you're too much inside your own head, and you walk off, you didn't appreciate that moment.
So what would cause that to happen?
Well, one of the best shows from my limited memories is selling out a theater that I used to envy as a child, and I'm like, and I've made it. It's sold out. It's great. This is great. I have a great show, and I get back to the hotel, and there's a note that's like from the person I'm involved with for the last 8 years, and they've decided that this life is not for them. Come on, that's funny. Come on. It just goes back to appreciating what you have in those moments. And I just enjoy that music is the thing that there are five of us on stage having these five different experiences that we're all playing. And you just feel this energy from the music and the people. And there's nothing like that. I mean, you know.
Actually, well, I was reading an old interview you did with Mark Anthony Thompson, great artist, often works under the name Chocolate Genius. And you said something about live performance that I also think this you especially will relate to this in terms of the band. You said, describing your playing with the band, we were playing our wave and falling and tripping and dirtying our faces. I love that because it involves both that idea of freedom and that idea of risk, you know, of getting dirty. What, and I throw this out to anybody, but what has to happen to get you to that place where you can be on the wave? What do you think, Mike?
Wow. Well, playing in a band that has a lot of allusions to water in the lyrics, it's a very big part of our band from release to, there's many, many songs amongst the waves, and mm-hmm. but to get into the nitty-gritty of touring and having a great night, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, how do you get to the point on stage? And any of you, actually, you all have great bands. You've worked really hard to put your band together. But, I mean, obviously Pearl Jam, I think of as a band that is so, yeah. it is one unit, you know.
I think it happens when you are connected completely with the audience and you're playing to the best of your ability, and we're in our situation as a band, you're communicating non-verbally, and you're just jamming. And when I'm closing my eyes and I'm playing and I can see the guitar neck, that's kind of the top, the euphoric state that happens that you kind of always are striving for, at least I am. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen all the time. You can't make it happen. It just kind of happens.
It has to happen. Like with me, with my band, I mean, it's nothing more. When you connect, and it's like when we were on the stage, there were 11 of us, and it's like to look around and to see their faces and to connect. Mm-hmm. And you can tell when we connect. And when we're on, you can't stop us. And the audience is on because they're looking at us, and they know. So it's just a big blade. You can just feel the energy when you come in the room, and that's the way I like it. I mean, every night it can't be like that. I mean, there's nights when I had to perform, and my mother had died that morning, And I had to go and do my show. I didn't say, I'm canceling. You know, and you go out there, and the band was like, they knew I was mourning. I was sad, but they was just watching me. And then when they saw me, the energy, it was there. When the tears fell, it fell with them. And I'm like, I mean, I'm crying, but I'm going on. You know, I'm not here to bring y'all down. Yeah. And it's like, that energy, you can't describe it. I mean, y'all sitting out there, and it's like so weird, but when it gets together on that stage, it's like, whoa. I mean, one night we was in Europe somewhere, and I was doing this thing, and I always do this shouting thing, you know, go to my heritage and bring out my, you know, always say I bring the church with me because, you know, and I really did this thing, and it was like, whoa. And it was like, I'm like, what happened? And when I got off the stage, I looked at the band like, what happened? And they were like, I don't know. And it was like, everyone in the band like, did you feel that? And we all just came off stage and started grabbing each other, hugging each other. It was like something happened on stage. And you're like, so it's good.
Out of body experience.
That's right. It really happens, yeah.
Well, putting together a band, I mean, Alinda, you worked for a long time to get the, and I know that the band you have now, you feel strongly that it not only represents you musically, but politically and presents, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how you got to that place after many versions of Hooray for the Riff Raff over the years.
Well, I've had a number of different bands for various albums, and I've always had I call him my partner in crime, Yossi Perlstein, who's my fiddler, and he also plays drums on a lot of the albums. We finally have found people, you know, we've always had this feeling that we wanted to blend our music with a feminist message and also a queer positive message, and we just recently were able to get some members that really felt that way as well, and who felt like they had to hide their identity or kind of, you know, that when they went out to play, they weren't bringing everything about them on stage. They had to go out there as a jazz, as a jazz percussionist, or go out there as a certain aspect, but they had to leave another part of them behind. And I feel like now that we are all able to be on stage together and be our full selves, it's been this really incredible experience. It's that feeling of looking behind you and saying, these people really have my back, you know? Right. These people are making my dreams come true, and I'm trying to make their dreams come true. And when you finally get that feeling, there's just nothing better. It's just this family that it makes it easier to appreciate every night, you know? It definitely makes it easier. You look around, I just try to say, I'm so thankful that you guys are here, you know?
That's right.
Michelle, you, unlike the other three people on stage tonight, you perform under your own name and just your own name, not the Dap Kings, not a band. So talk to me about putting your various groups together and how you've come to a place where you are still, you know, you are the solo performer in a sense, but I know for you, it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, I made a mistake. I just couldn't come up with a clever band name.
Well, Michelle and Dickichel is kind of a good name, don't y'all think?
Yes. I was looking for simplicity. I don't know, the band, that's an interesting question because I've gone through different configurations, and I think I've learned to communicate better because I realize now that I'm responsible for five other people in many ways, emotionally, financially, when we travel, how we travel. So I take it a lot more seriously, the relationship I create with them. But it's taught me maturity also because they're grown men. And so I learn a lot from them. And so I just try to have the utmost respect for them. But I used to go for the killinest musician who had the worst attitude. And now I go for the nicest guy who shows up, who I know will sit with me a few extra hours. And like, can we work out and find out how we can make this sound good between us?
And it seems to be leading. I mean, we'll hear a couple tracks on the new record shortly, but actually it seems to have reached this incredible balance. Like maybe the killingest musicians weren't getting you the killingest performances.
Right. Well, now I think I have a good combination of both. I play with someone, I mean, for the first time I can say they're actually my friends. And that was a bridge too, because they all play with a lot of other like super famous people, and when they, or if I don't call them, that's one thing I learned. Like sometimes drummer A doesn't work for this one thing you have coming up, and I think I've grown as an individual to say it's not you, it's nothing against you. I just need this. No disrespect. I'll see you at the next gig. Mm. So you have no illusions in your mind about what I'm thinking. Because I would want someone to do the same for me.
Do they handle it? I mean, are they
I'm like, please. I try my best to convey, like, I see you in the next gig. It just doesn't work for this. And so I have a great, now I have so many people to call because I've gotten better. I kind of used to be a jerk. Or, you know, overly sullen and not communicative. But I think that's what I've learned from them too, because I had a band member go like, you can't treat me like that.
Oh, really? Wow.
And I was like, you know what? Sorry.
And have any of you had that experience? Of like, I mean, I always think about that Metallica movie where they went to band therapy, which then in the end they just needed Robert Trujillo on the bass. It was like, he solved their band therapy, but I don't know, like when you're in a unit like you are in, I mean, is there ever a moment you're like, Stone, you're just not right for this song?
My favorite part of that movie is when the therapist starts writing lyrics, though. That's the greatest part. I got an idea, too, for this, Lars. $50,000 a minute for that guy. No, you know, with our band, we're always working on communicating, trying to have open lines of communication. We're still working on that. We don't always have it correct. We've made a lot of mistakes, but we're still around. We love each other, I think, as brothers and as business people and rock people. And I think there's a combination of we all came up together, and so there's a bond there. But, you know, we piss each other off, too. So we'll tell each other when that's the case. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. It's better to... Like I said, it's a constantly evolving thing of having communication issues. Mm-hmm. And it's not like we talk through lawyers or managers. We talk one-on-one. So,
which even after so much... I mean, in a sense, like having a long-standing 20-plus years relationship, it's not like those things go away. They just become refined and...
Yeah, I mean, resentments and things like that can run real, real deep. But yeah. But if you let them do that, it ends up destroying you. And I think we all enjoy what we do and cherish our music together and our fans and that we've had this opportunity to come out of Seattle and to be in this crazy museum or, you know, where I was when I used to play little tiny clubs where you'd have to book your own shows back in the early 80s. And so to be able to come up through that and still remember that, I'm very grateful that we're around now still, but it takes work. It's a lot
grateful.
Of communication things.
We are also grateful, or I am very grateful that you're still around. And, you know, we were talking about the Killinest musicians, and sticking with Mike for a minute, let's see a little of that first video, David, that we talked about. To me, at the end, you're doing Eddie Van Halen's Eruption, which I read that you have been trying to master since you were 11. Do you feel like you got there?
I feel like I'm almost there. There's a couple of tweaks. But the magic of YouTube is there's a guy that does it note for note, and that's where I was watching
really?
Him. But I did practice it for 8 months before doing that.
Really?
So.
Well,
I it was a challenge. I was like, I can maybe do this.
It's
but when it came out, I was 11. I'm like, what? You know, it was like Hendrix. It didn't make any sense. It was amazing, and it was.
Speaking of that, was sort of why I wanted to play that. Was talking about the idea of the repertoire, and in fact, this could apply to any of you, but particularly for you. You know, there's a lot of stuff all over YouTube. You can see Mike playing Hendrix licks. Maggot Brain, you do an amazing version of Maggot Brain, obviously this. And what is your relationship to that idea of a repertoire, and how important is it for a guitarist like yourself to master that? Because in rock, we don't necessarily think of a repertoire the way we do in classical music.
I think it's important as a musician, whether it be rock or jazz or blues, or to create and to be open to different types of music and try to maybe at first emulate that. Mm-hmm. And then out of that emulation, if that's a word, you create your own style. Mm-hmm. And so out of all of those guitar players that I liked growing up, Eddie Van Halen, Jimi Hendrix, guys from Aerosmith or Kiss or, you know, the Stones, all that, I try to take a little piece of everything. And Stevie Ray Vaughan later, and then Muddy Waters, and then some blues, and all of that was a whole nother world that opened up to me early on. So to creatively borrow things, and then it turns into your own style, I guess.
I could have played a similar video if it existed. Maybe one of you wants to make it, called Michelle and Digged Cello Bass God. nobody's made it, so I suggest you all make that video. But I read that you had a band where you had three bass players once.
Yeah, actually the band now is all
really?
Everyone plays the bass proficiently.
So talk to me about leading a band from that anchor, from the bottom.
I feel the bass player is a very important job. They ground the harmony. You also can move around, so you make a good band leader, and you're not the guitar player, so you don't have to play all that flashy stuff. And so your rhythm, your harmony, you control the groove. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wanted to be a bass player.
What's the longest bass solo you ever played?
I don't solo.
No, never.
I'm not that person. Oh, yeah. This is not my personality trait. I'm there to make everyone else look really good.
Well, let's look at shifting the topic a little. We're going to look at another video, and this takes on the subject of mobility more in the sense of mobility between styles or genres, and it's a song from Michelle's new record. Can we play a little of that video?
That you don't need enemies.
All right, can we fade
with friends
that out?
Like that you don't need.
So that's a little taste of an amazing cover of Friends, hip hop classic. She says I picked a weird one, but here's why I picked that, because I wanted to get into, and something you said in that clip, there she does a little interview before talking about how hip hop songs are not often covered in other ways, and I wanted to ask you about the transformation of that song, and also the mobility in that song of what you do to your voice when you treat it and you play with gender, because suddenly we have a male voice, or a maybe male voice, or maybe that's binary thinking on my part.
Well, it has nothing to do with gender. There's a style of music called screwing, like you screw the track.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to emulate that. If you hear the original version on the record, you'll understand. Also, that track was done by Houdini and the group Full Force. I don't know if you remember them. Yeah, right? And I always thought, if you really take the vocals off that track, it's really got intricate things, like that guitar part is actually the keyboard part, and it's kind of in this, it like adds a half beat to the bar of it, and that's why it kind of has this shift in it. And so I just wanted to show, I guess I get mad at my peers and people that are older than me who kind of are down, not really open to modern music and especially rap music. And I could take several rap tunes and really show you how intricate the music is if you really checked it out deeper than just going the surface. And then I also think the co-opting of the word friends lately is very interesting, so I just wanted to bring that back.
I'm feeling like maybe, as you have in the past done a Night of All Prince covers, maybe a Night of All Hip Hop covers would be kind of cool. Planting the seed. So cover songs in general, I mean, you've all done them. And I wonder, like, when you are trying to transform a song as a cover, like, is it most important to try to get away from the original? Or what I'm hearing from you, Michelle, is that you are trying to find an essence in the original that might have been overlooked. But I'm wondering.
May I say again? Sorry to talk so much. Well, it's something go back what he says. I think when you're a virtuoso like yourself, and you go to music school, they really should tell you the importance of transcribing other people's solos. Our classical musicians, like, you have to live by the music, you know, that's written, and somehow bring your own personality into it. I approach covers the same way, because if it's a really good song, you could just sit and play it at the piano and it works. So I think I love doing covers because it allows me to not take it so personally and just filter it through my imagination.
Alinda, on Small Town Heroes, your wonderful new record, you actually incorporate older songs into some of the songs. It's beyond just doing a cover. You're really, like, viscerally connecting with those older songs. And I wonder if you can talk about history as a mobile force within your music.
Well, when I go into my songwriting world, in my mind, I think a lot of these old songs and a lot of these old musicians kind of become these characters, you know, and that's just my way of interacting with them and kind of having this conversation that I think folk music is supposed to be. You know, you talk about emulating your heroes and then how slowly you become yourself, and that's a big part of folk music as well. When I was just starting to learn about how much I love to write songs, I would listen to songs and just write out the lyrics, you know, just see how does it feel to write this Bob Dylan song, you know? Like, what does it feel like to actually write it out? And besides doing something like that, you know, that I feel like is a conversation with your hero, even if they're not there. And it's a spiritual conversation in a way, you know? So that's what I'm doing as well when I write a song like the new San Francisco Bay Blues. I'm taking a song by Jesse Fuller that is the San Francisco Bay Blues that is such a classic, and, you know, everyone I know that plays folk music plays that song, and I thought I just wanted to write a song one day, and I started with the first line, and then, you know, it kind of took me on this much more feminine road, a much more just a different perspective, and I realized, oh, it brought me to, it was taking that song and making it my own, you know, just putting my own voice into that. So.
Which people always say it's like the cliche of American Idol, make it your own, but you're actually like making it your own in a very specific way, like writing yourself into that history. It's a very feminist act, I think. Another thing, sticking with Hooray for the Riffraff for a second, the complement to mobility is a strong sense of place. And I want to look at a video. We're going to jump into the middle of it. So this is actually with a band called the Daylons that are a great New Orleans band. And can we see a little of that, the video? It's called Saint Rock Blues. That's just a tiny taste. And one of the wonderful songs on Alinda's record, Small Town Heroes. But, I mean, I played that obviously so we can get into the subject of New Orleans. And tell us a little bit about where you made that video, what's happening in it, the song, and then just living in New Orleans, what you've learned from that.
Well, that video is really special to me because it's kind of, you know, me and Sam Doors, who is singing with me, we wrote the song Saint Rock Blues because I was living in a neighborhood called Saint Rock for many years when I first moved to New Orleans, and we experienced a lot of the violence in the neighborhood, and we lost some really good friends that I had known ever since, you know, I was growing up as a young punk kid in New York. And it was the first time I had really felt that pain that I just thought, wow, this is just a little portion of what the people of New Orleans feel all the time because of the violence in the city just being such a part of daily life there. And I thought, you know, if there's anything I can do, I can write a song about it. And it was just our way of saying, you know, we moved here, we love it here, we are so inspired by the city. The city has made us everything that we are now as musicians. And this is our way of writing this song saying, we feel it like you felt it, you know. And that's why there's a lot of second line footage. There's a band called the Hot Eight Brass Band that's playing in it, and there's some really amazing dancers. We just wanted to really try to reach out to the city and say thank you, and kind of, you know, the whole tradition of second lining is so amazing. And in New Orleans, mourning the death of your loved one is very public, and it's very musical. And it's been such an inspiration to me, so I wanted to do that with that song.
And you used to play on the street all the time in New Orleans, and I know we've talked about how you had to find, and I guess you were just talking about this a little bit, you had to find a way that wasn't appropriation or invasion.
Or try really hard. Yeah, as a young person moving to New Orleans after, you know, I first came there the year of Hurricane Katrina. It was the winter before. And coming back, I was gone for the summer. I came back and just seeing the devastation and seeing the pain of people around me that I really cared about, I just thought, you know, I don't know. At that point, I didn't know what else to do but try to play music and play on the street and learn. Mm. But it definitely made me think twice about what that is and how to not just try to stand and kind of, you know, witness this pain and not really go in and interact, you know. Right. It was very confusing dynamic, but definitely one that I tried to be extremely respectful.
And speaking, so we've talked about place now. I want to look at some time travel. So can we play a little of that next video? A video that takes place in the now, but invokes another moment in history.
And also has a great acting performance.
Lee!
Girl, hold on. What you doing there?
You damn well.
Hold on for a minute. Don't act all crazy, girl. Listen, you don't want to go in there. Listen, you don't want to be here right now. Sharon, calm
down.
Is
he in there, Lee?
Yes, he's in there. But
is he in
there? The man that take care of some business, Sharon.
Is he in there?
He's in there, but he's taking care of business. Oh, hold on. Baby, you know what the deal is.
Sharon,
calm down.
Don't tell me to calm down.
Listen, the man is in there taking care of some business, and I promise you. Let me go in and talk to him. You go on, calm down. No, don't act so crazy, girl.
Don't tell me not to act crazy.
I'm going to talk to him. I promise you. I'm going to talk to him. Keep you home a little while. I know what you need, girl. Just don't act all crazy like this.
Get
go on, baby.
You know I did stand your ass sometimes.
Damn. Ain't this a bitch?
That's how I learned the hard way from the wonderful Daft Kings record. I learned the hard way. I mean, first of all, that's just you and Lee Fields. You got to take it on the road. You have taken it on the road. What a dynamic. But I wanted to show that video because I think your style's amazing in that video. And it really gets at how, with the Dap Kings, you invoke previous eras. Visually, I'm feeling a little Diana Ross, a little like super fly blaxploitation happening in that. Other moments you've invoked, obviously, classic Motown. I mean, throughout the history of soul. And yet we feel that immediacy and that emotional connection to now. Mm-hmm. So this is a question others have asked you, but how do you bring history forward and make it something that we all relate to on such an intimate level through your music?
We don't, I mean, it's not like I'm trying. I mean, I just like Actually, that was actually my jacket I had in the closet.
Wow, I want to go into your closet. That's awesome.
I was like, yeah, I just pull this rabbit fur out. I'm just losing the fur. And I was like, so what do you want? And then I just said, let me just do my hair in an afro. And that was just my hair. And when, once someone, they gave me, like, this is what we're going to do. And I was like, okay. And he had the little script, the guy who did the video. I never know anything. It's like, what? We're going to be acting? And so that I had little lines. I was like, I forgot my lines for the rest. I just ad-libbed. There was such little lines. I like, oh, I can remember. And I like, just let me ad-lib. And that's what I do a lot on stage. I just ad-lib. I just feel it, you know, how it's going. And so that bit, that was so funny. Now that I look at that. And it was so cold. You see me, we was in Far Rockaway.
Yeah.
On the beach, yeah. In the snow, they had a blizzard, there had been a storm. And I thought they was going to cancel doing the video. Not. I was like, we're not going to do this video now. And they're like, oh, yes, we are. And so I was like, I'm on the beach. And then I'm like, you're on the beach with an umbrella and there's snow on the ground. You know? So I was trying to be all cool and everything, you know, outside. But it was really fun.
So that regal look you give, it's really just you being cold.
I was cold. I think, and even on the Learn the Hard Way album, you see me standing like that. We took that picture in the backyard of the Daptone. It was like 30 degrees or something. And so everyone would be like, okay, go outside. I take off the jacket and go. And so that last one, if you look at my face, I'm like, this is the last one. That face on it, I'm like, I'm not taking another picture. I'm kidding. So, yeah.
How to get a fierce look. Turn on the freezer.
Yeah, I can do that look. I like my look. So.
But what about on the new record, there are some tracks that sound to me like so much, like, even like there's some that's a little bit Ann Peebles or Dionne, there's even a Dionne Warwick record, but I don't know if you're even thinking about that.
Not thinking about
shaking
it
her head.
No, nah. I don't. It's just the guys, they come up with the music. Actually, the Dap Kings basically write the lyrics, all the music, and I'll take them and turn a word or two around, or I put the melody, or sometimes they'll sing like, you know, like Gabe, what you say about bass players? Gabe is the brains. I call him the master behind everything. He's the bass player. He also produced Amy Winehouse Back to Black, that album, so he got an award for that, you know. But he's like, he just writes stuff. When you're together for years, and the only reason why we're that tight is we've been together going on 19 years, and their history has it, you know, this and that, but we've been together. And so to get out there and they come up with these ideas, and when I hear the music, I'm like, I'm like, I hear Tina. I think I'll do some Tina to him, you know. Or I'll just hear something, I'll do a riff from some old song that I heard somewhere, but never do I go in there and say, I'm imitating, I'm going to be, you know, it may come out. They're like, like what you just said, oh, Janet Joplin, or Otis Redding. I'm like, yep, that was on my mind. And so, yeah, whoever anyone name, I'll be like, right. Just who I was thinking about.
We all live with our own archives in our head, you know, and I think all of us artists, writers, we bring that forward, and it is best when it's not studied in that way. Yeah. It's best when we have studied, but then we leave the studying behind. Yeah. And speaking of a different moment in history, now we're going to hear a little audio track. So let's hear that first audio track. We're speaking of a very different moment. Mike, I know you've talked about where this came from. You co-wrote this track.
That wasn't us. I'm sorry. So go ahead, please.
No, but you've talked about how you, the Dead Kennedys, a band I loved as a teenager growing up in Seattle too, played a big influence on this sound.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we saw before some of your metal influence. That clearly is a punk influence. I've always wanted to ask you about, like, reconciling those two sometimes considered opposite forces in Pearl Jam's music.
I think that that harkens back to the parties that we used to all go to, the Green River and the Shadow, and we'd all end up at the same houses because it was such a small scene back in the early 80s, late 70s, and we were all kind of friends and would drink the same crappy Rainier beer, and and someone would put on a Hanoi Rocks record, then someone else would put on a 45 Grave record, right, and then we'd put on Motorhead. Everybody could agree on Motorhead. It was such a small provincial town back then in terms of, you had to kind of really find, there was a small group of people that we all knew each other, mm-hmm, the punks and the metal guys and the girl groups, and everybody kind of knew each other.
And the New Wavers.
And the New Wavers. That was a big scene with the Heats.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Maurice and the Clichés and the Cowboys. That was the scene that was kind of right before us. But we were all influenced by that. But for me on that song, Align Your Banners, I wanted to approach it in a way of, I want to try to push myself and write a song that would sound like the Dead Kennedys, in terms of the lead that's in the middle of it, more like an East Bay Ray, not one of those notey, blah, 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 right, which is you saw me do earlier up in the video, but more of a melodic, dissonant, angular, anxiety-ridden type thing, so, which is part of my personality, too. So,
so let's go to the opposite direction sound-wise and hear this beautiful track from Michelle's new record, a little bit of it, just a little sample. That's just a tiny bit of a song that I am obsessed with. I'm obsessed with this song. What I love about this song is, I mean, in a strange way, it relates to some of the other songs we've heard. The last song, your song, in that the way it moves through time and builds on itself, there's a pattern there that's mysterious to me. And there's dub reggae in there. There's minimalism in there. I just want to know, like, how this track happened.
Comet Come to Me all has the same five letters.
That too.
That's how it came.
That's it? Really?
Just patterns on top of patterns. Huh. It's a piano pattern on top of another pattern. It's just layering. I again, come from hip-hop music. I love hip-hop music. I love sampling. And eventually, after people realize you can't do that, I just, in my mind, that's how I think of music. It's just layers of patterns on top of patterns. Huh. And just the emotion of when you say something over and over again to be understood, the repetition, African music. Uh-huh. I'm a really big fan of Bob Marley. Mm-hmm. It seems really simple, but it's not.
Right.
And the church the harmonies, like Leonard Cohen so profoundly describes in Hallelujah, you know, the way those chord progressions move, that uh-huh, move in emotion. Huh. So they're just patterns on top of patterns.
What do you all think of that? I mean, that seems kind of fundamental.
I love that. I feel like I'm learning something right now. I
mean, me too.
Seriously, I'm not being facetious. I feel, you know, that it's a cool way to look at music, because I haven't thought of it in terms
of
patterns
like that
before.
Too. Cool. It even flows that.
It builds.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Okay. Patterns on top. Yeah.
Cool. Wow. That's, all right. I feel like I've learned something, so that's huge. Right?
Well, we could wrap it up, but I think we need to, because we learned something, and that's awesome. And no, and I agree. And I want to encourage you all to listen to her amazing album, and that song particularly, it just will take you to that place. But also, there can be mobility in music about what a song means when you record it versus what it means when it's released. And I want to play a song from Sharon's new record, a little sample, and talk a little bit about how, for you, meanings change with this record. Can we have a little sample of that? First of all, this is a great song. Sharon, this is one of several songs on the new record that I know you recorded this record before you went through your experience with cancer. And you've talked about how these songs have changed for you now. And this seemed like one where you now might be talking a little bit to your body.
Well, actually, that wasn't one of the ones that I...
Well, that's the critic being put in her place.
I really didn't want to bust your bubble, but that was... Really, the song that I changed that had a meaning was Retreat. Uh-huh. That one, like, I see you coming from a mile away.
Let's hear a little more of it.
See? And you're looking real cocky. You know, and I thought of that song, like, you're talking to a guy, you know, tell him. But afterwards, when they did the video, and the animated video, and when I saw that animated video, the song did no longer was saying, I'm talking to this guy, telling him, mess with me, I'll go crazy. I was actually telling cancer to retreat. The little wolves was like the sickness, and I overpowered, and I came back. And I'm walking on the earth, coming back to give the people what they want. So that's the one Retreat changed. But that one, I like that song.
It's like a little
rock song. And every time I perform that song now, like, you know, I'll be like, you know, I'm like, I'd be like, you know, I'm like, I don't have hair right now, so when I get my hair back, I go like, they're like, no, see, what?
She'll be headbanging.
So, yeah, be headbanging. So. That's one of my heads, so I always tell them that. I can't wait till my hair grows back so I can shake it.
I want to play one last song that is actually a road song. Can we play a little of that song?
There's a crash on the highway today. Nobody's going anywhere, they say. It could be you up there, so you better say your prayers and take it easy on your narrow way. And we can make it to our gig on time, so we pull over and we drink some wine. They got a 5-car pile up in Rosenheim. Old driver, take me down. Germany's been cold and
that song so much. So it's a road song. It's a road song about loving the road and hating the road.
Yeah, that was, you know, there's that great London Homesick Blues, the song written about wishing that you were back in Texas when you're out in London, and mostly talking about how cold it is. That's a very common theme with country songs, wishing we were back at home. But that one, you know, we were out in Germany. We had about a two-week tour, and as excited as we were to be out there in the van, I just couldn't help but miss New Orleans and its ways and its bars, BJ's Bar. Just thinking a lot about being back with the people that know you, you know? Mm-hmm. So as fun as it is to travel, you know, homesickness is such a huge part of what we do, I feel like, so.
And my very last question is for each of you. What is a song that you like to play on the road that maybe ameliorates that, makes you feel a little less homesick, brings you to a place of peace? If you can choose one song to play, what would it be?
It's my song, When a Fish in the Dish, because I love going fishing. So I'd be like, and every time I'm homesick now. Let's do Fish in the Dish. And so I'll sing, I got a fish in my dish. So yeah, that's my song.
What about you, Mike? Is there a song you like?
In terms of our band or just...
On stage.
On stage.
Yeah.
Wow. Probably something that reminds me of home would be... God, I don't know. Probably Alive or one of those early ones. That
would work.
Yeah. I mean, there's one of the ones we played at the clubs around here, yeah. Probably would do that. But generally it's sitting in the hotel room, and if I mess around with Dead Flowers or playing a Stone song, then it kind of takes me back to like, oh, yeah, this is back when I did a bunch of acid and I listened to Sticky Fingers way too many times. So, like in the good old days when it worked.
Michelle, do you have one that you do?
Well, it varies. We have a resident DJ, the guitar player. And so the last tour, we were all homesick. We all fell in love with the Kurt Vile record. And that was like, okay, we're in this car or van again. And we just listened to that. I find him very soothing.
I think we've had an amazing talk tonight, and I thank you so much for your generosity for this long and wonderful discussion. Thank you all for hanging out. We're going to have a great conference, and hashtag EMP PopCon. Is there anything I should say, Eric? Thank you, and see you tomorrow morning. Yeah.